Welcome to 21 and 21. I'm Haley Burko, and today I'm speaking with Matt Pines. Matt is the executive director of the Bitcoin Policy Institute and a geopolitics and national security expert who applies a decade plus of experience to shaping U.S. Bitcoin policy. Matt, welcome to Presidio Bitcoin.
It's great to be here. My first time, great vibes.
First time, but hopefully not the last time. Well, thank you for taking the time to jump on the show. And we're just going to get right into it.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay. First question for you. So you've had a somewhat unconventional path into the Bitcoin world. What made you shift your focus to Bitcoin?
A few things. The first is my professional background kind of, I feel like, made it inevitable that I would bring a combination of kind of academic background in physics and philosophy, thinking about sort of big questions and connecting them to public policy, which is what I did my master's in. And then helping the government think about kind of a tail risks, sort of low probability, high consequence scenarios, you know, extended into cyber and geopolitics. While I had a personal interest in Bitcoin, and when I started to think about the future of Bitcoin, I couldn't help but look at it through the lens of my academic, policy, and professional background. And it seemed like a sort of a natural fit. And then David Zell DM'd me during the pandemic because I had written some random threads to nobody on Twitter, asking me if I would like to convert some of those threads into a white paper for this made up think tank they were starting. And I figured, what the heck, I'll try it. And so that was the start of my sort of journey into Bitcoin professionally as a national security fellow for BPI when it first got started. And it's just been ever since kind of attracted me more and more and more until just early this year, decided to sort of do the full pivot and become executive director. Where I feel like that's where I can have the most leverage. If the U.S. government is going to be pivoting, which it seems to be, in a pro-Bitcoin direction, how to ensure that it steers in the right direction and mitigates any potential risks while maximizes the upside for both America and Bitcoin itself. So maybe this is the time to kind of go all in.
Definitely is the time. And so you're in D.C. For a lot of our listeners here, me who's in San Francisco, can you tell us a little bit about what the Bitcoin scene is like in D.C. these days?
It's small, but growing. I would say growing up in D.C., which is where I was born in Silver Spring, Maryland. So I've been around the D.C. area. But before I got involved in Bitcoin, it was not a Bitcoin city. I think there has been, keepers of the flame in terms of the Bitcoin meetups. And there's a strong contingent of folks that show up to those. But I say relative to San Francisco or New York or Austin or Nashville, it's definitely, it's got some room to grow. I'm excited by the energy that has come out of the woodwork since the beginning of the year, really. And I'm really hoping that BPI can form as like a locus for some of these kind of cultural and community efforts in partnership with PubKey over the course of the rest of the year. So I think the vibes are growing. I think definitely, DC is a deal-making town. There's a lot of lobbyists, a lot of people in there that are transplants. So you kind of have to suss everyone out. What's their intentions? What are their motives? Are they Bitcoiners? Are they just sort of bandwagoning? So that's a part of DC. It's a different culture than I think other cities. But there is a core Bitcoin flame that is growing.
I love seeing the flame growing, and yes, I'm excited to see what PubKey does. From our side, it definitely we've seen interest and attendance growing from the BPI summit. I haven't attended, but that's great that that's getting bigger. What do you think is resonating most with people?
Well, I say to first order, right? The president has explicitly declared Bitcoin as a strategic asset for the United States government, signing an executive order, creating a strategic Bitcoin reserve, and going around and saying he wants America to be the Bitcoin superpower. So that just rhetoric coming out of the commander-in-chief, sitting in the White House, has an effect on everyone in D.C. That wouldn't normally pay attention to Bitcoin. Now they have to, right? Whether their views are formed and whether they're positive or negative, I think that's now sort of the shaping process that's underway. But I think we're seeing kind of a dramatic sort of tone shift, but also an Overton window shift in the types of policy conversations that we can have with very serious people across the government. Folks from the national security community, folks from Department of State, folks from the Treasury, folks from energy and EPA, across the board, folks at the White House, and on both sides of the aisle, there's a new set of conversations that are now being had about Bitcoin at a very serious level. And so that's very positive. I think that's sort of, that spark has been lit. Obviously, there's risk here. It's a very political town. And so the question of how much of these policy conversations get tied into politics is sort of, the work that we're trying to help do to separate out the sort of long-term analysis of Bitcoin and the strategic national interest versus, you know, the partisan politics that drives the news cycle.
Do you have any advice to Bitcoiners on how they can best communicate with policymakers or local government mm-hmm. representatives?
Be authentic. In fact, we did a sort of first of its kind Bitcoin day on the Hill on the day after our Bitcoin policy summit. And we were really overwhelmed. We had about 120 Bitcoiners. These were just, you know, everyday Bitcoiners who decided to come to this event, put on a suit. And we organized essentially a series of structured meetings with almost half of the Senate and about 60 or so House offices. And in fact, I think there were more Democratic offices. And it was a, you know, decent training. We sort of said, this is polite. You know, here are some, you know, talking points we want, you know, everyone to sort of resonate on the blockchain, you know, Regulatory Certainty Act to sort of make sure that non-custodial tool developers are protected, try to get that into the Clarity Bill. But all, really, everyone had their own approach. And it was about, you know, constituents speaking to their representatives and saying, I use Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin is good. I think you represent me and I want you to protect Bitcoin and to ensure that my interests as a constituent of yours are represented in DC. And that's for everyone to kind of take on their own shoulders and just give your representative a call or show up to their offices. They're, you know, it's an open democracy. And I think it was such a successful event. We're probably gonna do another one maybe later this year, sort of TBD on that. But it seemed like such a high ROI event just to actually have Bitcoiners from the district that are not lobbyists. They're not here representing a company or some special interest. They're just everyday people saying that Bitcoin is important. And I think politicians, you know, especially the representatives, they listen and that resonates differently than, you know, a suit walking the door with a give me something.
That's great advice. It's definitely a team effort from everyone, but thank you for all the work that you're doing local. So what do you think a world on the Bitcoin standard should look like?
Or
in your yes. in your opinion?
Well, that's not a 1 minute answer. I think there's some core principles of Bitcoin that I think our society would do well to adopt, which is a sense of self-sovereignty, responsibility, integrity, openness, transparency, honesty, and technical rigor, right? So building on a foundation that is open to all, that's inspectable by everyone, that ensures a level playing field. There's no, you know, in-group, there's no special interests, there's no insiders, there's no, you know, clerestory at the top that's dictating rules that everyone else has to follow. And it's a consent that's given and that's adopted by the whole community. And so I think about it more from a philosophical lens of how to construct political orders that are stable and legitimate as we enter an age of digital disruption. I think the economic model, as our overall society and civilization goes through these technological shifts, rise the acceleration of AI, robotics, you know, advanced manufacturing, combination of that with the sort of rewriting of the social contract, that's going to inject a huge amount of uncertainty and instability. And what comes out on the other end and what role Bitcoin will play, I have no forecast, but I think the principles of Bitcoin are going to be critical to ensure that we maintain kind of a pluralistic, decentralized structure. We don't fall into sort of techno-authoritarianism or techno-totalitarianism. We sort of default to, you know, the Borg, right? The hive mind that controls us and that dictates our whims and desires. I think Bitcoin represents an ethos of pushing power to the edges as much as you can and creating a stack of society that's built on as much as you can, energy, compute, money, and free expression, right? And it's like, that's the sovereign stack that as much as we can push into the hands of every individual and family and you know, pure organized social group, the more we're going to have, I think, something like democracy and civil society flourish throughout whatever disruptions come next.
So you're here for the Quantum Bitcoin Summit.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard you mention potential risks of quantum computing to Bitcoin. From a policy standpoint, what kind of government or institutional response do you think is needed? Is this urgent?
I don't think there's an immediate response needed by the government in terms of like a law passed or a rule made or regulation. I think that's definitely premature. I think we are seeing a development of the technology underlying quantum computing take a certain direction, which means that every stakeholder in Bitcoin or around Bitcoin has to pay attention and has to start considering these questions in a deliberate fashion. That's why I'm here today, sort of learn from the community, get a sort of a vibe check of where people are on one, the perception of the threat, the timeline of the threat, the way the threat might manifest and what the potential impacts could be, how catastrophic they are, and then what then are the distribution of mitigation options that we should consider in terms of software proposals, different addresses that we can move to, hourglass sorts of, you know, sort of buying us some time, or sort of other more radical propositions. We're still, I think, very early days in sort of canvassing the set of possible solutions. And in my view, I think, you know, Bitcoin and Bitcoin developers need to have this conversation internally first. The government, of course, is going to pay increasingly close attention to this as they have a strategic Bitcoin reserve, potentially maybe they even get more Bitcoin. But from another perspective, the US government is developing and probably has some of the most advanced quantum computers on the planet. So the threat that Bitcoin is and Bitcoiners are trying to mitigate, the US government probably has better insight into the nature and timeline of the threat than almost any other entity on the planet. And so this is going to set up a kind of a tension, right, between the inherent kind of suspicion inside the Bitcoin community for the US government as an actor and a set of actors that are both the political side, which may not be pro-Bitcoin, but also like the, quote, you know, deep state side, the folks, you know, in these three-letter agencies. And I don't think there's going to be a clear path that's going to be laid out immediately. It's about taking it one step at a time, being very deliberate and thoughtful, but also like looking ahead, right? If we do this, then what happens? And thinking about the distribution of scenarios. And so that's why I'm here to kind of suss out like what's the sense of these different possible scenarios. I have in my mind, you know, different possibilities, but there's inherent uncertainty here, both the timeline of the technology, the nature of how it might manifest in terms of the, you know, the small number of threat actors that you could model in terms of their intentions and capabilities to leverage a fault tolerant quantum computer. And so it's a very complicated topic. It's very fraught with both detailed, you know, like fundamental physics and engineering and, you know, speculative assessments of how fast that might progress, when you might trip the threshold for, you know, having a feasible attack on ECDSA, and then what are the different trade-offs associated with the different mitigation strategies? Jameson Lopp has his proposal. And I think this is about matching both the technical conversation, the analysis, the geopolitical kind of conversation, sort of as Bitcoin becomes a geopolitical asset, it's going to pull in governments into this conversation. And then these more ethical or philosophical trade-offs. What are the core commitments we have to Bitcoin? What might we have to give up in order to make certain mitigation decisions, right? In terms of burning old coins or locking them up, or putting time locks, et cetera. These are going to be inherent challenges to some basic principles that everyone thinks are core to Bitcoin. So there's no easy answer, and there's no, you know, ruler from on high who's going to dictate it. It has to form out of these conversations. So this is why I'm happy to be here.
We should have some really interesting conversations the next day and a half, and hopefully we'll all have a lot to share after that. But it's great that we're all getting together, and like such a diverse group of people in these conversations are needed, as you've mentioned. So do you have any book recommendations you've recently read that have been interesting?
Book recommendations. Okay.
It could be podcasts or movies too.
Yeah. Global Discord is a great one by Paul Tucker. He was the number two at the Bank of England. And it's a kind of a technical book, philosophical book, but it is sort of written from inside the house of, you know, Bitcoiners sort of you know, stipulated enemy, right? But he's a very thoughtful guy, very, very smart, very intellectual. And it basically gives a critique of his peers, critique of the global central banking community, and kind of the political order that it was premised on, this kind of 20th century model of top-down technocratic governance that they viewed as being very successful, kind of presiding over an era of global peace, financial integration, globalization, relatively low inflation after the 70s, and that imbued these you know, modern day high priests with a sense of undeserved confidence and maybe the sense of specialness as a tribe governing the rest of society and viewing money as like their thing that they own, that they sort of let society use. In fact, central bankers often refer to it as central bank money. It's like it's our money. We reserve the right to control how you use it or not. And so he really points a very strong light at this sort of this tension now that exists both between democracy and central banks, as well as the geopolitical order unraveling and putting a lot of tension on central banks being independent. And geopolitical prerogatives and national strategic interests come into play, and oftentimes central banks get subsumed. And so we're talking, and I think there was an article today about a letter that Trump had drafted, you know, that he was waving around in the Oval Office, that was apparently a letter that would fire, you know, Jerome Powell. And so these are live questions now we're seeing society kind of grapple with. But he wrote this great book to kind of diagnose it.
I'll check it out. How are you thinking about the intersection of Bitcoin and AI?
There's many different, I think, components of that intersection. I mean, the most obvious one we're seeing right now in the market is at the infrastructure level, the energy system, the grid system. We're seeing Bitcoin miners sell to AI companies or become AI companies or stand up, you know, HPC subsidiaries or side businesses. And there's a even more potential integration as you have these big training runs or large compute clusters that have a differential power demand profile. You can sort of put Bitcoin in as a kind of a load balancer. Kind of one, be a bit more efficient with use of energy, but also maybe help optimize the use of that power. So that's like practical happening right now. There's a much larger, maybe more speculative near future scenario where you have autonomous agents, potentially even running economically viable businesses on their own. And what are they going to use to transact and save the earnings that they have from conducting these autonomous economic activities, cross-border, essentially transnational? And if they can't hold bank accounts, you know, it's going to be difficult for them to set up like the normal sorts of infrastructure, like a C corp or an LLC. And so the natural inclination would be to say, well, they might use a combination of stablecoins and Bitcoin. A little bit more hypothetical, but I think the end state is going to be driven by these dynamics. And I think Bitcoin will be increasingly important to how we think about a digital economy that's riding on a compute infrastructure that's the foundation of modern civilization. And countries are going to have to decide what's their sort of national policy for building this sort of sovereign stack, their sovereign energy layer, their compute layer, their AI layer, and their money layer. And ultimately, I think countries are going to want to be as sovereign as possible. But I think that desire is going to be fractal throughout society. And it's not just going to be for individuals. It's going to be for these economic agents that are going to make, you know, increasingly, you know, what we would look like economically rational decisions. And it's, I think, even a smart AI would be like, well, maybe I don't want to hold, long-term treasuries, right? It doesn't seem like a great place for me to store my wealth. So that's going to be a fascinating development. But I think, yeah, Bitcoin and AI are going to be two core, drivers. And the last point is they're both on like these, hockey sticks, right? And so AI is on this hockey stick and Bitcoin, I think, is also on this hockey stick. And it looks kind of like the hockey sticks might line up in the next few years. And so those interdependencies and those that dynamic between those two accelerating phenomenon is going to be very important to look at. That's a lot of what BPI is going to be focused on as well.
It definitely feels like a hockey stick for sure, especially AI. Things are happening so quick. There's so much more you can do now. And yeah, it will be really exciting to see. Do you have any dream projects that you would love to see Bitcoiners build?
Ooh. One thing I think the market's lacking is a large, well-capitalized, ideally, publicly listed, sort of all-in-one Bitcoin services company that had, everything from trading to custody to inheritance, tax planning, insurance, right? So imagine you took all the kind of great Bitcoin companies that we kind of know and love, and they're building really good verticals in different areas. My ideal would be to have like one-stop shopping, where I could just be like, this is the greatest, this is the Bitcoin company. And it sort of rivals, the publicly listed equities right now. But there isn't really a household name, Bitcoin, publicly listed, all-in-one financial services company. I think we're on that trajectory. I think it'd be exciting to see in the next year or two whether something like that can take shape. But just like speaking selfishly, like I would want that, right? Instead of having like account here to do this and another, these are all great companies, right? But like eventually it would be nice to have like at least... And then have some competition, right? Have them kind of build something. So like that, I think, is part of the institutionalization and just like more consumer friendliness of Bitcoin that I think it needs to catch up to.
Well, maybe we can get some vibe-coded prototypes on this idea.
Yeah, that's the other convergence of AI and Bitcoin. People can just start building stuff.
We can just start building stuff. So shout out to the listeners if anyone wants to get started building on this. Couple more questions. So I have to ask you, do you have any spicy Bitcoin takes?
Ooh, spicy Bitcoin takes. I think China has more Bitcoin than America right now, which is a problem if you're, someone sitting inside DC. Yeah, I think China probably has, I guess, close to 200,000 Bitcoin. And I think we probably have, depends if you count Bifinex, but I think we probably have closer to 40.
Wow. Yeah. Quite a big difference.
Mm-hmm. And the Bitcoin that's maybe not counted at 40 is Bitcoin that's held by other government agencies. We'll see if they put it into the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve, though. As they're told. Yeah.
On a more optimistic note, what gives you hope now for Bitcoin's future?
I just think, it's a bit cynical, right? But I think you get the call from, you know, your mom or your aunt, and they say, "Oh, I just bought some, you know, iBit," right? And you're like, "Oh, that's not exactly what." Not exactly Bitcoin, but I feel like that is the gateway, and their cost basis and their sort of unit bias is the share price of the ETF. Now that's not the best way to kind of, you know, get someone into Bitcoin, but it's probably going to be the way people come into Bitcoin now. And so I think I'm optimistic that is the largest funnel we've ever had to pull people into Bitcoin, to have them ask questions about it. Because once they have it in their portfolio, then they have some skin in the game. And now they want to understand what this thing is. And most, you know, humans are, you know, limited creatures. We have only so much time in the day to spend to like dig into something, right? And Bitcoiners are sort of self-selected to be curious about either the philosophy of political order in a changing digital society, or the nature of money, or cryptography, or game theory, or computer science. And so we have some sort of reason to care about Bitcoin that usually brought us in. And then we're like, "Oh, this is the greatest thing ever invented. Like, I'm going to like obsess about it." Most people are not like that. Most people come in because they have a bit of financial exposure to it, and then they have to learn. And so we're in this moment, I think, where more people are having exposure to Bitcoin and have skin in the game than have ever had it. And so that's an exciting opportunity for education, right? So I'm very hopeful. Like, there are now going to be millions more people with like open ears that are going to be curious to learn about Bitcoin. And I think Bitcoiners now have this obligation to meet them where they are, to come with education materials, to provide that easy on-ramp that doesn't assume all the shibboleths, that isn't speaking encoded language or, you know, kind of the in-group canon, but like is digestible and is like an easy way to get people to understand what this thing is and why it's important.
It's definitely, education is hard, and it is hard too when you've been in the space for a while to kind of go back to like where you were at, mm-hmm. at the very beginning, and maybe how your Bitcoin educational journey could have been improved.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a whole batch of Bitcoiners who created in the pandemic, and they were just on Clubhouse listening to Twitter Spaces, or listening to Clubhouse Spaces, and then now it's Twitter Spaces. Those are maybe not the best didactic tools. I think some of them were great, but like, you know, they're shouting fests or people in there that are just making stuff up, and you know, you challenge ideas, but you learn, you know, that's one way, but that's probably not the most efficient way to get you know, a million people to like understand what this thing is. And so developing digestible content and making it resonate with people that, you know, come from a very different place than most Bitcoiners would be very important.
Totally. Last question. If you could leave our listeners with a single thought about Bitcoin or anything else, what would it be?
Reality is malleable. I think one of the lessons that I've taken over the past year is just how one contingent like world historical events are, and how much like individual agency can do to shape the developments there. Like, there are thousands of different little micro movements that happen in the world on any given day. And like more people than I think recognize the fact that they might be in a position to shift some of those moments, and those can have dramatic outcomes. I think Bitcoin, the community that I've kind of, you know, plugged into in the last few years, is remarkably small in terms of like the degree of close-knitness and just the number of people involved. And yet that community of pretty small people is actually having like world historical effects, I think. I think this moment in time is one of high agency and high leverage. But it's like recognizing that you have that and then picking your spots, not being overconfident, but also not shying away from the moment that might present it to you. I think Bitcoiners are now in this tussle where like, ooh, the government, you know, likes Bitcoin, but like, oh, that, I'm suspicious of that. And that's like, it's right to be suspicious, but also it's an opportunity, because the government is, at least in the United States, nominally by and for the people. And so if you, you know, use your voice and actually engage, you can actually put your hands on the gears and be like, this is actually the direction that we could all push in. And it doesn't take a whole lot to actually push things in the right direction, at least from your perspective. And so, yeah, just this, the power of agency is the most thing. I mean, I was maybe a late awakener to that idea. I was, you know, doing the grind consulting you know, hustling out PowerPoint decks and realizing that the average CEO is just going to do their own thing regardless, right? I'm just a hired gun. And so realizing you can just not do that. You can be like, okay, well, that's not where I'm having the most high impact. I'm going to do something where I can have the most high impact. So find that thing you can have the highest impact and just go do it.
That's fantastic advice. Well, thank you so much for joining the show. If our listeners want to learn more about you or anything you would suggest that they read or follow, anything you want to shout, what should they do?
Yeah, we'll follow our work at btcpolicy.org. We're a 501c3 nonprofit. We've got a great team, 10 full-time staff, 23, 24 fellows. Now we're always looking for new fellows that have a willingness to lend their expertise and to, you know, write white papers or contribute to research or education on Capitol Hill. So, you know, we're just a think tank that produces, you know, jibber jabber about Bitcoin to try to, you know, change hearts and minds inside DC. So if that appeals to you, like, support or engage.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for coming on again. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your time at Presidio Bitcoin and the Quantum Bitcoin Summit, and have a great time in San Francisco.
Thanks for having me.
Of course.